Editor's note. Reading Conley's statement, Mr. Arnold pointed out the use of words which he declared no Negro would naturally have used. Quote, "These were long words with many syllables in them. They said that Conley used so much detail in his statements that he could not have been lying." End quote. Editor's note. He then read parts of statements which Conley had repudiated as willful lies and pointed out the wealth of detail with which they were filled. Quote, "And yet they say he couldn't fabricate so much detail. Oh, he is smart." Editor's note. He then read the statement of May 24th in which Conley admitted writing the notes. In this, he shows three different times at which Conley stated he wrote the notes, these being early in the morning, at 12:04, and at 3 p.m. Quote, "The statements were not genuinely Conley's. Take the word Negro. The first word that a nigger learns to spell correctly is Negro, and he always takes particular pains to spell it N-E-G-R-O. He knows how to spell it. Listen to the statement. He says that at first he spelled the word Negroes, but that Frank did not want the S on it and told him to rub it out, which he did. Then he says that he wrote the word over. Look at the notes. He was treed about those notes, and he had to tell a lie and put upon someone the burden of instructing him to write them. The first statement about them was a blunt lie, a lie in its incipiency. He said he wrote the notes on Friday. This was untrue and unreasonable, and he saw it. Frank could not have known anything of an intended murder on Friday from any viewpoint you might take, and therefore he could not have made Conley write them on Friday." Ah, gentlemen of the jury, I tell you these people had a great find when they got this admission from Conley. If Conley had stayed over there in the tower with Uncle Wheeler Mangum, he would have told the truth long ago. There's where he should have stayed, with Wheeler Mangum. My good friend Dorsey is all right. I like him. But he should not have walked hand in glove with the detectives. There is where he went wrong. My good old friend Charlie Hill would not have done that. He would have let the nigger stay in the jail with Uncle Wheeler. I like Dorsey. He simply made a mistake by joining in the hunt and becoming a part of the chase. The solicitor should be little short of as fair as the judge himself. But he's young and lacks the experience. He will probably know better in the future. Dorsey did this. He went to the judge and got the nigger moved from the jail to the police station. The judge simply said, "Whatever you say is all right." Now, I'm going to show you how John Black got the statement of Conley changed. I'm going to give you a demonstration. I have learned some things in this case about getting evidence. They say that Frank cut Conley loose and he decided to tell the truth. Conley is a wretch with a long criminal record. Gentlemen, how can they expect what he says to be believed against the statement of Leo M. Frank? They say Conley can't lie about detail. Here are four pages, all of which he himself admits are lies. They are about every saloon on Peter Street, saloons to which he went, his shooting craps, his buying beer, and all the ways in which he spent a morning. There is detail enough, and he admits that they are lies. Now, in his third statement, that of May 28th, he changes the time of writing the letters from Friday to Saturday. Here are two pages of what he said, all of which he afterward said were lies. He says that he made the statement that he wrote the notes on Friday in order to divert suspicion from his being connected with the murder, which happened on Saturday. He also says that this is his final and true statement. God only knows how many statements he will make. He said he made this statement voluntarily and truthfully, without promise of reward, and that he is telling the truth and the whole truth. He said in his statement that he never went to the building on Saturday. Yet we know that he was lurking in the building all the morning on the day of the murder. We know that he watched every girl that walked into that building so closely that he could tell you the spots on their dresses. We know that he was drunk, or had enough liquor in him to fire his blood. I know why he wouldn't admit being in that building on Saturday. He had guilt on his soul, and he didn't want it to be known that he was here on Saturday. That's why, when they pinned him down, what did he do? He says that he was watching for Frank. My God, wasn't he a watchman? He said that he heard Frank and Mary Fagan walking upstairs, and that he heard Mary Fagan scream, and that immediately after hearing the scream, he let Montine Stover into the building. Why, they even have him saying that he watched for Frank. When another concern was using the very floor space in which Frank's office was located, and you know they wouldn't submit to anything like that. Look again. He says that Mr. Frank said, "Jim, can you write?" What a lie! He admitted that he had been writing for Frank for 2 years. It's awful to have to argue about a thing like this, gentlemen. You will remember Hooper said, "How foolish of Conley to write these notes." How much more foolish, I say, of Frank to do it. I don't think that Newt killed the girl, but I believe he discovered the body some time before he notified the police. Newt's a good nigger. Scott said that it took Conley 6 minutes to write a part of one note. Conley said that he wrote the notes 3 times. They say that nigger couldn't lie. Gentlemen, if there is any one thing that nigger can do, it is to lie. As my good old friend Charlie Hill would say, put him in a hopper and he'll drip lie. He was trying to prove an alibi for himself when he said that he was not in the factory on Saturday and told all the things that he did elsewhere on that day. But we know that the wretch was lurking in the factory all of Saturday morning. Further, he swore that while he was in Frank's office, he heard someone approaching, and Mr. Frank cried out, "Gee, here come Corinthia Hall and Emma Clark," and that Frank shut him up in a wardrobe until they left. According to Conley, they came into the factory between 12 and 1 o'clock, when, as a matter of fact, we know that they came between 11 and 12. And as for his being able to fabricate the details of his statement, why, he knew every inch of that building from top to bottom. Hadn't he been sweeping and cleaning it for a long time? With this knowledge of the building, he naturally had no trouble in his pantomime after he had formed his story. The miserable wretch has Frank hiding him in the wardrobe when Emma Clark came in after the murder, when it has been proved that she came there and left before Mary Fagan ever entered the building on that day. They saw where they were wrong in that statement, and they made Conley change it on the stand. They made him say, "I thought it was them." They knew that that story wouldn't fit. Do you remember how eagerly Conley took the papers from the girls at the factory? And do you remember how, for 4 or 5 days, the papers were full of the fact that Frank's home was in Brooklyn, and that his relatives were reported to be wealthy? Conley didn't have to go far to get material for that statement he put in Frank's mouth. It so happened, though, that Frank really did not have rich relatives in Brooklyn. His mother testified that his father was in ill health and had but moderate means, and that his sister worked in New York for her living. Gentlemen, am I living or dreaming that I have to argue such points as these? This is what you've got to do. You've got to swallow every word that Conley has said, feathers and all, or you've got to believe none of it. How are you going to pick out of such a pack of lies as these what you will believe and what you will not? Yet, this is what the prosecution has based the case upon. If this fails, all fails. And do you remember about the watch, where Conley said that Frank asked him, "Why do you want to buy a watch for your wife? My big fat wife wanted me to buy her an automobile, but I wouldn't do it." Do you believe that, gentlemen of the jury? I tell you that they have mistreated this poor woman terribly. They have insinuated that she would not come to the tower to see Frank, had deserted him, when we know that she stayed away from the jail at Frank's own request because he did not want to submit her to the humiliation of seeing him locked up and to the vulgar gaze of the morbid and to the cameras of the newspaper men. The most awful thing in the whole case is the way this family has been mistreated. The way they invaded Frank's home and manipulated his servants. I deny that the people who did this are representative of the 175,000 people of Fulton County. We are a fair people, and we are a chivalrous people. Such acts as these are not in our natures. Conley next changes the time of the writing of the notes to Saturday, but denies knowledge of the murder. That, of course, did not satisfy these gentlemen, and they went back to him. They knew he was dodging incrimination, so they had him to change the statement again. Scott and other detectives spent 6 hours at the time with Conley on occasions and used profanity and worried him to get a confession. Hooper thinks that we have to break down Conley's testimony on the stand, but there is no such ruling. You can't tell when to believe him. He has lied so much. Scott says the detectives went over the testimony with Dorsey. There is where my friend got into it. They grilled Conley for 6 hours, trying to impress on him the fact that Frank would not have written the notes on Friday. They wanted another statement. He insisted that he had no other statement to make, but he did change the time of the writing of the notes from Friday to Saturday. This shows, gentlemen, as clearly as anything can show, how they got Conley's statements. In the statement of May 29th, they had nothing from Jim Conley about his knowledge of the killing of the little girl, and the Negro merely said that Frank had told him something about the girl having received a fall and about his helping Frank to hide the body. Oh, Conley, we are going to have you tell enough to have you convict Frank and yet keep yourself clear. That's a smart Negro, that Conley. And you notice how the state bragged on him because he stood up under the cross-examination of Colonel Rosser. Well, that Negro has been well-versed in law. Scott and Black and Starnes drilled him. They gave him the broad hints. We came here to go to trial and knew nothing of the Negro's claim to seeing the cord around the little girl's neck, or of his claim of seeing Lemmy Quinn go into the factory, or of a score of other things. Yet, Conley was then telling the truth, he said, and he had thrown Frank aside. Oh, he was no longer shielding Frank, and yet he didn't tell it all when he said he was telling the whole truth. Well, Conley had a revelation, you know. My friend Dorsey visited with him 7 times. And my friend, Jim Starnes, and my Irish friend, Patrick Campbell, they visited him, and on each visit, Conley saw new light. Well, I guess they showed him things, and other things. Does Jim tell a thing because it's the truth, gentlemen of the jury? Or because it fits into something that another witness has told? Scott says they told him things that fitted. And Conley changed things every time he had a visit from Dorsey and the detectives. Are you going to hang a man on that? Gentlemen, it's foolish for me to have to argue such a thing. The man that wrote those murder notes is the man who killed that girl. Prove that man was there, and that he wrote the notes, and you know who killed the girl. Well, Conley acknowledges he wrote the notes, and witnesses have proved he was there, and he admits that, too. That Negro was in the building near the elevator shaft. It took but two steps for him to grab that little girl's mesh bag. She probably held onto it and struggled with him. A moment later, he had struck her in the eye, and she had fallen. It is the work of a moment for Conley to throw her down the elevator shaft. Isn't it more probable that the story I have outlined is true than the one that Conley tells on Frank? Suppose Conley were now under indictment, and Frank out. How long would such a story against Frank stand the pressure? In the statement of May 29th, there are any number of things that are not told of which later were told on the stand. In the May 29th statement, Conley never told of seeing Mary Fagan enter. He never told of seeing Montine Stover enter, nor of seeing Lemmy Quinn enter. Now he tells of having seen all of them enter. Don't you see how they just made it to fit witnesses, and what the witnesses would swear? It was, "Here, Conley, swear that Quinn came up, swear that the dead girl came up, and swear that Miss Stover came up." They all did, and it's true. Swear to it. And Conley would say, "All right, boss, I reckon they did." And it was, "Conley, how did you fail to hear that girl go into the metal room? We know she went there because by our blood and hair we have proved she was killed there." And the poor Negro thought a minute, and then he said, "Yes, boss, I heard her go in." The state's representatives had put it into the Negro's head to swear he heard Frank go in with her, and that he heard Frank come tiptoeing out later, and that, by that method, they made Conley swear that Frank was a moral pervert. Now, I don't know that they told Conley to swear to this and to swear to that, but they made the suggestions, and Conley knew whom he had to please. He knew that when he pleased the detectives, that the rope knot around his neck grew looser. In the same way they made Conley swear about Dalton, and in the same way about Daisy Hopkins. They didn't ask him about the mesh bag. They forgot that until Conley got on the stand. That mesh bag and that pay envelope furnished the true motive for this crime, too. And if the girl was ravished, Conley did it after he had robbed her and thrown her body into the basement. Well, they got Conley on the stand, and my friend Dorsey here asked Conley about the mesh bag, and he said, yes, Frank had put it in his safe. That was the crowning lie of all. Well, they've gone on this way, adding one thing and another thing. They wouldn't let Conley out of jail. They had their own reasons for that, and yet I never heard that old man over there, pointing to the sheriff, called dishonest. He runs his jail in a way to protect the innocent and not to convict them in this jail. Gentlemen, right here a little girl was murdered, and it's a terrible crime. The Fagan tragedy, the crime that stirred Atlanta as none other ever did. We have already got in court the man who wrote those notes, and the man who, by his own confession, was there. The man who robbed her. And, gentlemen, why go further in seeking the murderer than the black brute who sat there by the elevator shaft? The man who sat by that elevator shaft is the man who committed the crime. He was full of passion and lust. He had drunk of mean whiskey, and he wanted money at first to buy more whiskey. End quote. Editor's note. Mr. Arnold asked the sheriff to unwrap a chart which had previously been brought into court. It proved to be a chronological chart of Frank's alleged movements on Saturday, April 26th, the day of the crime, and Mr. Arnold announced to the jury that he would prove by the chart that it was a physical impossibility for Frank to have committed the crime. Quote, "Every word on that chart is taken from the evidence, and it will show you that Frank did not have time to commit the crime charged to him. The state has wriggled a lot in this affair. They put up little George Epps, and he swore that he and Mary Fagan got to town about 7 after 12. And then they used other witnesses, and my friend Dorsey tried to boot the Epps boys' evidence aside as though it were nothing. The two streetcar men, Hollis and Matthews, say that Mary Fagan got to Forsyth and Marietta at 5 or 6 minutes after 12, and they stuck to it, despite every attempt to bulldoze them. And then Matthews, who rode on the car to Whitehall and Mitchell, says that Mary Fagan rode around with him to Broad and Hunter Streets before she got off. Well, the state put up McCoy, the man who never got his watch out of soak until about the time he was called as a witness, and they had him swear that he looked at his watch at Walton and Forsyth. And he never had any watch. And it was 12 o'clock exactly, and then he walked down the street and saw Mary Fagan on her way to the factory. Now, I don't believe McCoy ever saw Mary Fagan. Epps may have seen her, but the state apparently calls him a liar when they introduce other testimony to show a change of time to what he swore to. It's certain those two streetcar men who knew the girl saw her, but the state comes in with the watchless McCoy and Kendley, the Jew hater, and try to advance new theories about the time and different ones from what their own witness had sworn to. Well, we have enough to prove the time, all right. We have the streetcar schedule, the statement of Hollis and Matthews, and of George Epps, the state's own witness. The next thing is, how long did it take Conley to go through with what he claims happened from the time he went into Frank's office and was told to get the body until he left the factory? According to Conley's own statement, he started at 4 minutes to 1 o'clock and got through at 1:30 o'clock, making 34 minutes in all. Harley Branch says that he was there when the detectives made Conley go through with what he claimed took place, and that he started then at 12:17, and by Mr. Branch's figures, it took Conley 50 minutes to complete the motions. Well, the state has attacked nearly everybody we have brought into this case, but they didn't attack Dr. William Owen, and he showed by his experiments that Conley could not have gone through those motions in 34 minutes. Jim Conley declared that he started at 4 minutes to 1 o'clock to get the body, and that he and Frank left at 1:30. If we ever pinned the Negro down to anything, we did to that, and we have shown that he could not have done all that in 34 minutes. Away with your filth and your dirty, shameful evidence of perversion, your low street gossip, and come back to the time. The time element in the case. Now, I don't believe the little Stover girl ever went into the inner office. She was a sweet, innocent, timid little girl, and she just peeped into the office from the outer one. And if Frank was in there, the safe door hid him from her view. Or if he was not there, he might have stepped out for just a moment. Oh, my friend, Dorsey. He stops clocks, and he changes schedules, and he even changes a man's whole physical makeup, and he's almost changed the course of time in an effort to get Frank convicted. Oh, I hate to think of little Mary Fagan in this. I hate to think that such a sweet, pure, good little girl as she was, with never a breath of anything wrong whispered against her, should have her memory polluted with such rotten evidence against an innocent man. Well, Mary Fagan entered the factory at approximately 12 minutes after 12. And did you ever stop to think that it was Frank who told them that the girl entered the office when she entered it? If he had killed her, he would have just slipped her pay envelope back in the safe and declared that he never saw her that day at all, and then no one could have ever explained how she got into that basement. But Frank couldn't know that there was hatred enough left in this country against his race to bring such a hideous charge against him. Well, the little girl entered, and she got her pay, and asked about the medal, and then she left. But there was a black spider waiting down there near the elevator shaft, a great passionate, lustful animal, full of mean whiskey and wanting money with which to buy more whiskey. He was as full of vile lust as he was of the passion for more whiskey. And the Negro, and there are 1,000 of them in Atlanta who would assault a white woman if they had the chance and knew they wouldn't get caught, robbed her and struck her and threw her body down the shaft, and later he carried it back, and maybe, if she was alive, when he came back, he committed a worse crime. And then he put the cord around her neck and left the body there. Do you suppose Frank would have gone out at 1:20 o'clock and left that body in the basement, and those two men, white and denim, at work upstairs? Do you suppose an intelligent man like Frank would have risked running that elevator, like Conley says he did, with the rest of the machinery of the factory shut off, and nothing to prevent those men up there hearing him? Well, Frank says he left the factory at 1 o'clock, and Conley says he left there at 1:30. Now, there's a little girl who tried the week before to get a job as stenographer in Frank's office, who was standing at Whitehall and Alabama Streets and saw Frank at 1:10. Did she lie? Well, Dorsey didn't try to show it, and according to Dorsey, everybody lied except Conley and Dalton and Albert McKnight. This little girl says she knows it was Frank because Professor Briscoe had introduced her to him the week before, and she knows the time of day because she had looked at a clock as she had an engagement to meet another little girl. That stamps your Conley story a lie blacker than hell. Then, Mrs. Levy, she's a Jew, but she's telling the truth. She was looking for her son to come home, and she saw Frank get off the car at his home corner, and she looked at her clock and saw it was 1:20. Then, Mrs. Selig and Mr. Selig swore on the stand that they knew he came in at 1:20. Oh, of course, Dorsey says they are Frank's parents and wretched liars when they say they saw him come in at 1:20. There's no one in this case that can tell the truth but Conley, Dalton, and Albert McKnight. They are the lowest dregs and jailbirds, and all that. But they are the only ones who know how to tell the truth. Well, now Albert says he was there at the Selig home when Frank came in. Of course he is lying, for his wife and the Seligs prove that. But he's the state's witness, and he says Frank got there at 1:30. And thus he brands Conley's story about Frank's leaving the factory at 1:30 a lie. Well, along the same lines, Albert says Frank didn't eat and that he was nervous. And Albert says he learned all this by looking into a mirror in the dining room and seeing Frank's reflection. Then Albert caps the climax to his series of lies by having Frank board the car for town at Pulliam Street and Glen. Now, as to the affidavit signed by Manola McKnight, the cook for Mr. and Mrs. Emil Selig. How would you feel, gentlemen of the jury, if your cook, who had done no wrong and for whom no warrant had been issued, and from whom the solicitor had already got a statement, was to be locked up? Well, they got that wretched husband of Manola's by means of Graven and Pickett, two men seeking a reward, and then they got Manola, and they said to her, "Oh, Manola, why don't you tell the truth like Albert's telling it?" They had no warrant when they locked this woman up. Starnes was guilty of a crime when he locked that woman up without a warrant. And Dorsey was, too, if he had anything to do with it. Now, George Gordon, Mignola's lawyer, says that he asked Dorsey about getting the woman out, and Dorsey replied, "I'm afraid to give my consent to turning her loose. I might get in bad with the detective department." That's the way you men got evidence, was it? Miss Rebecca Carson, a forewoman of the National Pencil Factory, swore Frank had a good character. The state had introduced witnesses who swore that the woman and Frank had gone into the woman's dressing room when no one was around. I branded a culmination of all lies when this woman was attacked. Frank had declared her to be a perfect lady with no shadow of suspicion against her. Well, Frank went on back to the factory that afternoon when he had eaten his lunch, and he started in and made out the financial sheet. I don't reckon he could have done that if he had just committed a murder, particularly when the state says he was so nervous the next morning that he shook and trembled. Then the state says Frank wouldn't look at the corpse. But who said he didn't? Nobody. Why, Giesling and Black didn't swear to that. Now, gentlemen, I've about finished this chapter, and I know it's been long and hard on you, and I know it's been hard on me, too. I'm almost broken down, but it means a lot to that man over there. It means a lot to him, and don't forget that. This case has been made up of just two things: prejudice and perjury. I've never seen such malice, such personal hatred in all my life, and I don't think anyone ever has. The crime itself is dreadful, too horrible to talk about, and God grant that the murderer may be found out. And I think he has. I think we can point to Jim Conley and say, there is the man. But above all, gentlemen, let's follow the law in this matter. In circumstantial cases, you can't convict a man as long as there's any other possible theory for the crime of which he is accused. And you can't find Frank guilty if there's a chance that Conley is the murderer. The state has nothing on which to base their case but Conley. And we've shown Conley a liar. Write your verdict of not guilty, and your consciences will give your approval. You've been listening to our continuing audiobook series featuring the best writing from the American Mercury on the Leo Frank case. Be with us next time when we'll continue with the next installment of the American Mercury on Leo Frank.